Com.
Well, what's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, April 20th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour here, as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports with a betting focus. We'll be joined here in a couple seconds by Wes Reynolds. We'll talk golf, the Shenzhen International on the European Tour, the Valero Texas Open on the PGA Tour, and also with the Players Championship coming up in 3 weeks. Maybe we'll touch a little bit on that as well. It's Wednesday, hump day. It's also hoops day. That means we've got Cole Ryan's second edition for this week of Betting the Buckets NBA playoffs, of course, well underway now. So a lot of good information coming that way from him. I will have NHL playoffs and MLB thoughts later in the show. Also an apology to one of our listeners regarding our MLB discussion from last night on Twitter. Coming up the rest of the week here, on Thursday, we'll talk to Jordan Bianchi of SB Nation, go over all the NASCAR events coming up here this weekend in Richmond. We'll have Jay Primetown from MMAOddsBreaker.com to break down UFC 197. And I think there's a small chance that with Jay Primetown, we'll talk about Conor McGregor and the bombshell announcement coming out of his camp. And then coming up on Friday, with the final installment of Cole Ryan's Bang the Buckets for this week, also talk with Joe Everett from NFL Draft Bible. Take a look at what's going on with the NFL draft, which is rapidly approaching. Hard to believe it's about time for that. I don't think there are any prop odds out there yet, but I'll take a look around and see what I can find in the lead up to that segment. But if you have any questions for Joe Everett from at NFL Draft Bible on Twitter, please shoot them over to us, either to myself at Skating Tripods or at Bang the Book. We'll see how many of those we can get to on Friday's show. And then, of course, throughout the week, I'll keep updating you on the NHL playoffs and the MLB side of things as well. But for now, we'll get into our golf segment for this week. Bring in Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, how are you today, sir?
I'm good, Adam, and you?
Doing very well. Appreciate you taking some time here this week. I know it's a very busy time with the playoffs going on and these two pretty interesting golf events that are very, very different. You've got this Shenzhen International, which is a new tournament on the European Tour side, only the second year for that, and the Texas Open, which has been around forever.
Yeah, excuse me, had a frog in my throat there. A lot has been made of the European Tour not really having a lot of events in Europe so far, and they actually went back and then went to Asia and then went back to Europe. They had the Middle East swing early in the year, but now they're going back to China, and then they go to Morocco next week. And then I always mispronounce this name, so forgive my ignorance, Mauritius for an event. And then they go back to Europe and pretty much stay there until the end of the year. But this is going to be, it's a very interesting week. The Valero is a okay field, but it doesn't have, you don't have your top, four or five guys. You don't have Day or Spieth or McIlroy. And then here in the Shenzhen, you do have Bubba Watson going over for a nice appearance fee, more than likely playing this event. He's really the only full-time American player in the event. There's a couple other European Tour players that are Americans, like Peter Uihlein, et cetera, that are in this event as well.
Well, we've got 3 weeks to go here until the Players' Championship. What do you expect to see over the next 3 weeks in terms of, guys are going to be playing these events? I know that you said last week that the Wells Fargo should get a very good field there at Quail Hollow, but are you expecting a similar thing for the Zurich Classic next week?
I'm not really sure. I know that I mentioned Bubba a minute ago. Bubba Watson usually plays that New Orleans event, and so does Dustin Johnson. So you may see them in the event. You're not going to really see, I think, all of the players together until the Players' Championship. Jason Day made a comment last week that he feels like he lost some weight and some strength, and I think he's played a lot of golf. And, when you saw his round on Saturday where he shot several over par, his worst ever third round ever on the tour, I think it was 78 or 79, he was kind of spent, and you could tell he was kind of spent. So I'd be surprised maybe if we saw him until the Players. I think Jordan may play the Wells Fargo. I haven't looked ahead on the entry list yet or the commitment list, but you know, I think guys, you know, they just got through a big part of the schedule with Doral, WGC event, and then finishing up the Florida Swing, and then, of course, the Match Play and the Masters. So this is kind of the next couple weeks where you're going to see some guys play, some guys not play, and then, you know, it obviously picks up to the players, and then the Memorial, and then there's a little bit of a lull. Some guys will play the Dallas-Fort Worth event, and then some guys will take off maybe until the U.S. Open.
Well, we'll see how things play out. And that's one thing that I don't think people really talk about a whole lot in golf. I mean, you and I have talked about it with some of the players that have played European Tour events and have come stateside or vice versa, with fatigue being an issue for them. But that's not really something that gets a whole lot of play here in terms of golf handicapping.
Yeah, I mean, you can only play so many events. And, I mean, even top guys, you know, especially more so with guys that are kind of middle of the pack or guys that are, you know, trying to keep their car or keep their status. I mean, guys, you know, when you have that status, you can pick which tournaments, you know, okay, this is a course that's really good for me, or this is a course that's really not good for me, and not play in the event. So, I mean, you take your opportunities where you can get them to get really good finishes, and I'll kind of touch on that with one of the guys I picked this week with the in the Valero, you know, guy that, you know, usually plays well there. So, I mean, it's always interesting to see how these guys make their schedules out.
Well, we'll go over to China here for the Shenzhen International. And you know, I thought that it was interesting, and this is something I said to you in our Twitter conversation here, is that, you know, we've talked about China and how it's kind of starting to become a pretty major player on the international golf landscape. And here they are with back-to-back events here in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, they've got – there's money. I mean, every – excuse me – every single sport enterprise wants to be in China, you know, whether it's golf, whether it's tennis, whether it's auto racing. You know, IndyCars wanted to do a race in China. I mean, that's kind of the next real emerging sport market outside of what you see in Olympic competition, with where they do very well, usually gymnastics, diving especially. They really are the powerhouse worldwide in the sport of diving. So, you know, you're kind of seeing them maybe, you know, you saw it with basketball with the emergence of Yao Ming and a couple others, but they're starting to become more of a player in the global sport marketplace. So there's money to spend and money to be made. So that's why a lot of these organizations are going over there.
Well, and as you mentioned, one guy going over there who's getting a pretty big check to do it probably is Bubba Watson, who is the tournament favorite here. He was around 5-1 earlier in the week. Some places have him about 6-1 now. But obviously there's not a whole lot of value in Watson this week. But does he really have that good of a shot to win this event?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you're a top 10 player like Watson is, I mean, you can almost win every single week. And he has won over there. He's won over in Shanghai in the HSBC over there before. So, you know, this is not unfamiliar territory for him. But, I mean, at 5-6-1, I really, you know, might try to put my money elsewhere other than on Bubba.
Well, what about this course here? You know, as I said, it's just the second year of this event. I'll probably butcher the hell out of this name, but that Genzon Golf Club. And, you know, it's a par 72. It seems like it's got some birdie and eagle opportunities on the par fives. Is this a course that's going to help the long hitters this week?
I think long hitters can do very well, but it does require some accuracy. It does have water. I think it's called a Dragon Lake, and there's water on a lot of the holes. But, I mean, you do have some mid length kind of par fives. You've got there's three holes on the course that are below 400 yards for par four. So, you know, it is inviting you to kind of, you know, see if you can drive the green or get it real close and hit a, you know, 20-30 yard pitch, you know, for the longer hitters like a Bubba Watson or what have you. You know, to really kind of go at this and be aggressive. So, you know, it does tempt you.
Kiradek Afa Barnrat was the winner last year in the inaugural event, won in a playoff over a guy that we'll talk about in a few minutes here, one of the Chinese players. But Afa Barnrat going off about 14 or 15 to 1 here this week. Was there any desire to play him?
I considered it. I mean, you know, keep in mind when he won this last year, he was 40 to 1. So now he's 14 to 1. And that's a big jump. Or a big drop-off, you know. So I thought that, maybe that was almost a little too obvious. He's obviously got the best form here considering that he won last year. But I went elsewhere with these to try to, you know, get some guys maybe underneath that I think can fare well or either have played well here in the past or guys that are playing well coming in.
Well, the smallest pricer you've got this week is Ross Fisher, about 20 to 1 there on that price. What are you seeing from Fisher that you like this week?
Well, I mean, Ross was in contention last week at the he really, you know, doesn't have, I guess, what you would call great form, considering he had 5 weeks off before he finished sixth at the Open de España last week. And he was really kind of in the mix because that event, for those listening that watched, that was probably the toughest course maybe you'll see all year on either tour. I mean, the winning score was 1 over par. And, Fisher was kind of in the mix, ended up finishing sixth. Think maybe, you know, he's got a little something going here and can contend here. He just he has played this event before. I take that back. Last year he was 15th in this event. So, you know, he does have a little bit of familiarity and then comes in with some confidence off a really good finish. And if he caught a couple breaks, you know, might have been in the mix to contend for the win last week.
It seems like several of the guys that you have here on your card this week with a course that, you know, we don't really have a whole lot of data on, are guys that you've sort of backed with some sense of regularity here this week. Guys like Hend, Rumford, Olesen is another guy that makes your cut this week. If you could give the listeners some kind of idea on, you know, what it is about these guys that, you know, that you've liked both this week and then also throughout the year.
Well, Hend is a guy that he's an Australian player that plays a lot on the Asian Tour, splits his time kind of between the Asian Tour and the European Tour, so he's always, you know, in the mix. He's actually already won earlier this year, but, he's a guy that somehow is up there all the time on these Asian events when they're, you know, combined with the European Tour events. Another guy back was Alexander Levie, who actually won this event 2 years ago, finished 25th last year, and also was actually the leader at one time in the Spanish event last week, but kind of collapsed a little bit over the weekend and finished 14th. But he is a guy that, just makes the short list for me. He finished it. He had an 81 on Saturday, which took him out. I mean, but those conditions and the course was just really demanding. But he did come back with 2 under on Sunday. So, you know, he's a guy that actually has played well in events that might have some weather, which this event might be. Won in Portugal in 2014, which was weather affected and actually got cut to 36 holes. Very good. He's got 5 consecutive putts made. Total driving. He's really done well in some of these Asian events. He was top 20 in total driving in Malaysia. Was very good in Perth, where he almost beat Louis Oosthuizen. So, Levie was another guy that I liked this week. Torbjørn Olsen, reason I went with him, he's played well in China before at the HSBC last year, which is a event in November, shot 64 in the first round, ended up, you know, finishing top 20, and that's a very good field and usually. And, you know, also played well in the Middle East. He's kind of been a little bit hit and miss. Didn't play too badly last week at Valderrama. So he's a guy that I think, you know, might be a little bit of a middle price surprise here.
One of the things I think that we can keep an eye on with the European Tour, and I you touched on this last week, I want to elaborate on it a little bit more here, and then we'll switch over to the PGA Tour side, is Ryder Cup placement for these guys and how important some of these events are going to be here over the next 4 months, because the cutoff for the Ryder Cup coming up here in late August.
Yeah, and Olofsson is a guy. He's not a guy that you immediately think of, because I mentioned some of the newer players that have had great years, like the Danny Willett and Danny Willett's and the Rafa Cabrera Bello. And then, you know, some of the veterans that are trying to make the team that are usually on it, like McDowell and Coulter. Well, Olofsson really isn't that far away. I mean, he's 67th in the world right now, so he's just on the cusp of being in that top 50, you know, which when you're in that top 50 on the world golf rankings, I mean, we saw that Brandon Grace got his, you know, from South Africa, got his official two-year exemption last week winning the RBC Heritage, but he's able to get in a lot of tournaments or most of the tournaments because he's top 50 in the official world golf rankings. Well, Olofsson is about 67, so he's not that far away. So, you know, a win or a, you know, second, a couple top fives are going to, you know, pay some decent points and get him in there into that top 50. And then, you know, that gives you access to pretty much play every single event, and then obviously stock up further points.
Well, we'll move over to the PGA Tour side of things here. The Valero Texas Open, as I mentioned, this is one of the longest standing golf events on the PGA Tour circuit. The first one back in 1927. So it's been a long time. 1922, actually. It's been a long time that they've been playing this event. But only the last 6 years has it been at TPC San Antonio. We've had six different winners in that span.
Yeah, it's a Greg Norman design, the AT&T Oaks course at the TPC San Antonio. It actually has ranked as a pretty hard course last year. Now, this was mainly because of the weather. It ranked the second toughest course on the tour last year, and the average score was 2.5 over par on a round. So, but this is usually in the top third in terms of probably, you know, your more difficult courses that they play on the PGA Tour. You look at some of the winning scores since it's been here. Adam Scott, I'll go from 2010 forward. Adam Scott was 14 under Brendan Steele, 8 under Ben Curtis, 9 under Martin Laird, 14 under Stephen Bowditch, 8 under Jimmy Walker last year as the champion was 11 under. So this isn't a tournament where you're going to see, you know, 20, 21 under. You know, you're usually probably going to see in between maybe 10 to 12 under on average. Not a birdie fest type of course. And three of the par fives are actually over 590 yards. So contoured greens. So these are kind of testy greens. You don't see a lot of roll on the fairways. So that's actually, even though this is seen as a ball striker course, length can play a big factor here, and I had a couple bombers on my list this week.
As you mentioned, Jimmy Walker, the reigning champion, played his collegiate golf at Baylor, so I imagine he's played this course a time or two, you know, outside of just in his professional days. But, you know, a guy that's played really well here but doesn't seem to be a whole lot of value in this 15-50, 16-1 type of price.
No, not really, and I mean, a lot of the golf previews that, and a lot of the stuff I've read have said this is not really a great field. But, I mean, you got some pretty darn good players in this field, I think. I think, you know, you got a guy off a win, Brandon Grace, who's now 11th in the world. You have Brooks Koepka, Zach Johnson, Patrick Reed, Phil Mickelson, J.B. Hall. I mean, this is a pretty solid field, I think, this week. I don't think this is a bad field. I mean, this isn't like it's the, Puerto Rico Open, where it's an alternate event with Doral or the John Deere, which is usually the week before the British Open, where you don't get a lot of the top players. So, you know, pretty solid field and, pretty evenly priced. I mean, there's about 10, 11 guys, 30-1 or worse. So this is a pretty open event.
I actually got two questions for you here, and I'll start with the one about the prices for picking the winner here. Because Day, Spieth, and McIlroy aren't in this field, and if Ricky Fowler was in it, he'd probably be the favorite, so we can include him as well. Because those top four guys aren't in this thing, do you feel like that makes it a little bit more difficult because so many guys are priced in that 20 to 25 type of range, or do you prefer it that way?
Well, I mean, you really could make an argument for both sides. I mean, obviously, if one of the favorites are in the field, you're probably going to see the odds a little bit more spread out amongst those players that are kind of in the top here. But, it also brings a lot of guys into play and, where you can maybe, take some shots, take some guys that you're getting some decent players with good form at 60, 65, 66-1, something like that.
And then the other question is, you mentioned Brandon Grace coming off of his first PGA Tour win last week. You don't have any matchups posted on your Twitter timeline yet, and that's at WesReynolds1 for the listeners out there. Is Grace a guy that you're looking to fade here this week coming off that first win?
He's only got I only see a couple matchups for him, and I'm going to do those later this afternoon. But I know Jimmy Walker is a little bit of a small favorite over him, and him and Cooch are pretty much a pick 'em matchup. Some might have Grace as a small favorite. Some have Cooch as a favorite, like Chris has Cooch 120 to Brandon Grace's take back of even money. But, that's something I may look to do. And not that I think he's going to play bad here, but I mean, that's a big milestone, for an international player to now, okay, I got my exemption now, I can play whenever I want, So sometimes when you have an accomplishment like that, there's a little bit of a sense of relief because, had he known he was going to win last week, maybe he would have taken this week off. And, you kind of saw that a little bit somewhat with Jason Day last week, where the only reason he really played the RBC Heritage is because he's sponsored by RBC. I mean, he didn't really, I don't want to say he didn't want to be there, but, he had such started out well his first two rounds, and then he kind of just wore down and got off to a bad start Saturday and just kind of imploded, which means, it happens to everybody. And, he was just fried, I think, from the schedule he's been playing. So, There's something certainly to be said about maybe going against a guy who, has had some kind of accomplishment or some kind of milestone.
Well, we talked about that 20 to 25 to 1 type of range. You've got three guys in that range here this week. You've got Brooks Koepka, J.B. Holmes, and then lefty Phil Mickelson, who eventually he's going to get over the hump here and grab one of these. But let's look at Koepka first at 22-1 here, the smallest price that you've picked for this week. Is this a course form play? Is this how he's playing heading into this event? Is this a course that matches up well for his skill set?
I think it is because obviously Brooks is one of the bigger hitters in the world. Really destroys par fives. We'll be able to go at a lot of greens. I mentioned earlier that there's a three par fives on this course that are very close to 600 yards. And, he's a guy that, I think could just destroy those and, put numbers up and make birdies. There's a few, some guys that really can't go at all of those. So, him and also, J.B. Holmes, who's also a bomber and, fares well, I think, at these type of courses. He's also a guy, Holmes, that has played well here in the past. He has a lot more course form than Koepka. Holmes kind of very sneaky was in that top 10 at the Masters. Didn't play last week, but he's a guy that does have history at San Antonio. Was once the 54-hole leader here. Finished just outside the top 10 in 2010 and 2011. He's a guy that fits. Phil, also another guy who is never bashful about going for it, doesn't have a ton of history here, had a withdrawal 2 years ago and finished 30th last year. But in all the quotes I've read for him, he really likes the course, really likes the event. And, I'm not going to hold that Masters miscut too much against him because he had been playing well. He played pretty solid in Houston, should have won Pebble Beach, but missed a less than 5-footer to get in that playoff. But, he's had a lot of really good finishes this year, still playing pretty good golf at his age. This is maybe a week that it could happen for him because it's wide open and you don't have the Goliaths, I guess, at least on the tour right now in the event.
Three guys in the 40 to 50 to 1 range: Kevin Chappell, Jason Kokrak, and then Chris Kirk, who you listed at 50 to 1. DSI right now showing Kirk at 40 to 1. So I don't know if that's one that's kind of moved around, been a little bit of a popular pick here this week. But I know Chappell specifically is a guy that you pointed out to me as somebody that's played very well here on this course.
Yeah, and these are also guys, sometimes you mix them up a little bit, I guess, with course form and also with, recency form. Chappell and these guys, Kirk was right in it until he went for it and tried to make a birdie and ended up making a big number on a hole that took him out really of a top five finish last week at the RBC Heritage. But these are guys that really all played well. Kokrak was in the final group last week at the RBC Heritage with Luke Donald. Chappell was also up there over the weekend, ended up finishing ninth last week. So, these are guys that I think sometimes you'll take an event where you played really well and then transfer it over to the next week. And then I had a couple course form guys here. Aaron Baddeley, who finished ninth last week at the RBC Heritage. And Baddeley is also a guy that historically plays pretty decent here. He's got a third in this event the first time it was here and two other top 20. So, some wide open guys, I think guys that can keep that momentum going for what they had last week. So, those are guys that did make the cut as well.
One of those course form guys that really stands out here, who's been as good as anybody at this course and probably better than most people, is Daniel Summerhays, who's going at about 60 to 1 here. This guy, obviously not a big name, but it's something about this course at TPC that, seems to work out for him. I mean, he finished fourth last year, and then he was second in 2014, seventh in 2013. I mean, three top seven finishes is really, really impressive. I don't care what course you're playing or who's in the field.
Yeah, and there was a quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it, so I'm just going to paraphrase it. There was a quote last year in some of the media availability where Summerhays was saying, if they could play every event here at this course and at the Valero Texas Open, if we could play here every week, I'd be a top 10 player in the world. And, I'm loosely paraphrasing there, but, a guy whose form you just can't ignore. And I mean, it's a horses for courses play. And I think, when we were having a little exchange earlier in the week, I looked at kind of, okay, who typically plays well in this course. It's one of these horses. It's one of the first things I look at, and I mentioned several guys, and Summer Hayes was one of them. I believe Freddie Jacobson was another one. Aaron Baddeley, who I did play this week. Charlie Hoffman is another guy. I think you're seeing a lot of support for Charlie, and I still may eventually play him, but man, it's so tough with Charlie Hoffman because we see him. He's there several times a year. It seems like every season, several times a year, he's got a shot to win one of these things and just can't finish. On Sunday, he was there last week at the RBC Heritage and just is not able to always finish. So, you know, that's why I kind of left him off. Brennan Fields, another horse form guy. Charlie, going back to, I just pulled the numbers up, has an 11th, 11th, a 3rd, a 13th, a 2nd, and a 13th here. So, you know, if Charlie Hoffman maybe is a top 20 prop, if you get like a top 20 or a top 10 prop at your particular book, you know, wouldn't be the worst guy to pick. You know, guys that typically play well are usually going to play well, but unless they're an injury or they're just totally off kilter coming into an event.
One guy I wanted to ask you about, and then I'll let you go and get about your day. Jerry Kelly. Jerry Kelly, a guy that finished sixth in 2014, didn't really putt very well last year. That kind of hurt him a little bit. But he did lead this event in driving accuracy in 2012. And one of the things I read about this course is that some of the landing spots can be a little bit narrow on the fairways here. Was that a guy that was on your radar at all? He's priced about, 107-1 or something like that?
I didn't take him, but Kelly is one of those guys that's made a very – decent living on the tour. He's an older player. I don't know his age, but he's got to be in his mid to late 40s. He's a guy that, you know, has made a living on playing well consistently, like I talked about earlier, at the courses you know that you can play well on. You know, something like this or the John Deere, the old Greater Milwaukee Open that they used to have. I mean, you know, those select few events that a lot of these guys have, you know, where it's like, you know, man, you know, like I was saying about Summer Hayes, where he can play, you know, this event 15, 20 times a year. I mean, you know, so Kelly, I don't think would be a bad option in the triple digits. I had a couple triple digit guys that I took small positions on with Ricky Barnes and Andrew Luke, who's a pretty big hitter who I think may find this course to his liking. But, you know, Kelly's definitely not the longest guy, but, you know, hits it dead straight, and hitting it dead straight can make up sometimes for a lack of length.
Well, Wes, a lot of good stuff, as always, from you here on these PGA events. Is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with? Maybe, you know, something that they could try to incorporate into their handicapping as we go along here throughout the golf season? Any kind of, you know, stat that seems to have stood out to you this year? Any kind of adjustment that you've made?
Well, I mean, you know, it's going to vary week to week, but, I mean, strokes gained putting is something I look at. With some of these longer courses, you're looking at par 5 scoring average in terms of that. Scrambling, especially when you get to some of the tougher courses, like, you know, when you get to Muirfield for the Memorial in a couple weeks, it's now called the Dean and DeLuca, but I still call it the Colonial in Fort Worth. I mean, courses where you're not going to see, you know, huge, you know, 18, 20 unders very often, you know, where it's going to be where, hey, 10 under par may be good enough to win, or 9 under par may be good enough to win. So, you know, look for your scramblers, you know, around the green, you know, guys when they miss the greens that can recover and make pars, you know, and move on, that those don't turn into double bogeys. So, I mean, those are kind of some different stats I look at. I mean, it's going to vary course to course, but I guess, you know, those would be the main things I'd look at.
Well, thanks a lot, Wes. Good luck this week. We'll talk to you again next week, man.
All right, Adam. Thanks a lot for having me, man.
Good stuff there from Wes Reynolds. We'll be right back after a quick note from DSI Sportsbook.
This segment of Bang the Book Radio is brought to you by the Bet DSI Sportsbook. DSI is one of the industry leaders in customer service, wagering options. It offers an exclusive 300% deposit bonus to readers of BangTheBook.com and listeners of Bang the Book Radio. Simply sign up with a promo code BANG300. Again, that's BANG300, and start winning today.
Make sure you head on over there to DSI Sportsbook, also the promo code BANG10 available at your disposal. We're going to go ahead and get into the Wednesday edition here of Cole Ryan's Betting the Buckets.
Thank you, Adam, and welcome everybody to another Betting the Buckets segment. Very exciting time of year and a wonderful hoops day for everyone, and I have plenty of NBA playoffs to talk about. I'm going to cover a bunch of things today. I'm going to go beyond the box score for three games that really stood out to me, some things that I caught watching these games, and I've watched them all, that I really think are important from a handicapping perspective. I'm going to talk about the zigzag theory and if my opinion has changed or not, or whether or not it is dead. I'm going to talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder and why I think they're not going to win a championship. I will also make an outrageous prediction, and of course, I'll have multiple picks against the spread, brag about the Buckets Brigade, my Twitter followers, and talk NBA basketball all segment long. So let's get started. As you know, blazing quick, this time with a bunch of picks, and I'm going to start with Beyond the Box Score, and I'm going to start with my beloved Boston Celtics. I proclaimed this series was over, and with the way they played against the Hawks in Game 2, it is awful. It's tough to watch. And look, Brad Stevens, not won a playoff game, still a great coach, but man, does he have his hands full. He's working on bringing in rookies. He's working on filling spots. They were missing, of course, Avery Bradley and Olynyk too, which to me was probably one of the tougher losses because they were just dominated. I mean dominated in the paint. But the rookies are what really stood out to me. They failed to rotate on more than one occasion. At one point, they held the ball too long, and not only held the ball too long and lost possession, but then there was a technical as Rozier threw it at Schroeder. And so it was just tough to watch. The shooting was bad enough. It was Boston's lowest scoring playoff quarter. No. Any quarter since the NBA was founded in 1949. That's how bad it was. But what really stood out to me was how the Hawks dominated in the paint. They had a franchise playoff record, 15 blocks. Anytime the Celtics went in the paint, they couldn't get the shot they wanted to. It was embarrassing. They were outmatched down low. But the most important thing to me that stood out, the Hawks have not played a complete basketball game yet. They're not looking very good at all, and they're 2-0. They may be the best-looking basketball team at this point that's 2-0 because they've played so bad. If they actually play as well as they can, they're going to be very well. So I think they're probably under the radar. They're probably still not getting that respect they deserve out the East, but I think they have good coaching. They have good depth. They have good players. I think they can go far. As I mentioned before the playoffs started, I think if you can still get them 10-1 to win the East, it's worth looking at. I want to quickly talk about San Antonio Spurs. Man, this team is focused. What really stood out to me is not the fact that they're drubbing Memphis. Everybody thought they would. Not the fact that they played defense so well. It was record-breaking against Memphis. But it's how focused they are. Popovich had them in a huddle, and he basically said, hey, let's play with pride. They were up by 29 points. I mean, at that point, you could coast through it. But that's not what he said. Instead, he said, play with pride. I really think they want the sweep. I'm not going to go out on a limb and say they're going to cover every game, but I think they want the sweep because I think they want the rest because I think they see Golden State hobbled with a few injuries. The one, of course, to Curry is the one I'm talking about. And they could take advantage of that by making sure their team is 100% and ready to go for their next series. Finally, I want to talk about the Houston Rockets, and I blasted them on Twitter. What a mess. They're fighting on the court every game. They're not listening to their coach. Their selfish play. Every little thing that happens to this team just derails this team. They were actually in the game, in Game 2 against Golden State. They had a chance to pull off an upset without Curry in the lineup. They self-destructed. You could tell Harden and Howard do not like each other. There's even talk about Harden taking a different bus after the playoff game. Howard's killing himself in free agency. Look, Harden is very difficult to play with. That has been documented. But now if you look back at Howard and every team he's played with over the years, he has had struggles with every player he's played with, especially superstars like Harden and Kobe. So I think it's going to be tough for him to get to a certain team. Is he going to get a max contract? Yes. But It's only because the NBA's got so much money to throw around. I really think he's hurting himself. Not to mention Houston, by the way, 0-5 all time in the postseason on Golden State's home court, 1-6 overall in the playoffs. If I'm Golden State, I sit Steph for as long as possible. Until this becomes a series, Curry doesn't play if I'm the coach. If I'm Curry, he's not playing. It's just that simple. Let's move on to the zigzag theory. I said it was dead. I said it's not worth looking at. And then, of course, it comes out and goes 3-0 on Monday night. Now, on Tuesday night, it went 1-1, depending on how you look at it. If you bet on a team that lost, it went 0-2. If you bet on a team that lost against the spread, you could argue that you would have had Atlanta. I don't think it matters. I wrote an article about the zigzag theory, and that if you bet game two, zigzag theory, after Monday, it was 207, 159, and 13, which is about 56-57%, which is a good return. But to me, it's still dead. If you want to consider it a little bit, sure, go ahead. Do your handicapping. Don't base it just on a system, especially one that seems to have dried up. I say pass on that. I want to talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder. Look, at the beginning of the playoffs, I said this is a team that could really win the championship. And, in fact, I offered a chance to buy into them late in the regular season when they were on a losing streak and everybody was kind of selling them because I think they had value from a betting perspective. I don't like how they finished that game against Dallas. Look, they're not going to lose to Dallas. It's not going to happen. And Kevin Durant, he had his worst postseason shooting performance both by percentage and number of misses in his career. 26 misses, most he's had in 716 career games. That includes regular season of playoffs. He's not going to do that every game. He's going to make his baskets. They're going to beat Dallas. Even if this is a close series, Dallas is not going to upset Oklahoma City. So I don't see that happening. What I did not like is that they do not play team basketball. It's either Durant or Westbrook down the stretch. I get it. They're the star players. I get it. They should get the ball. But it's not even a question. I mean, in the last 5 minutes of the game, those were the only two guys who took shots. I really think you have to get more players involved. You have to get more of a role players involved. And they have the talent on this team to do that. To me, until they start spreading around that basketball, I'm not sold on them winning a championship, although they're a pretty good team. So just keep that in mind. I just did not like what I saw in Game 2. And it had nothing to do with the results. It's just the way they were playing basketball down the stretch. Now, I have an outrageous prediction. Watch the Minnesota Timberwolves coaching search. I know this is kind of getting out of the playoffs a little bit, but they're talking to Thibodeau, Mark Jackson, Van Gundy. To me, if they get any of those, it is a slam dunk. This team right now is in perfect position to do well if they get a good coach. To me, if they get Tibbs, not only will this team be a playoff team, I think they could be a contender. Now, I'm not going to say they're going to win a championship. I'm not going to say they're going to win the West. But what I'm saying is they can go far in the playoffs. I think they will be a team to watch for sure. So keep an eye on that coaching search, although it's outside of the playoffs. But let's get to the picks. 3-0 on my picks as I gave them out last segment. Like to keep that going. And I'm going to start tonight with the Charlotte Hornets against the Miami Heat. You're getting about 4.5 points. This line is real low. The bandwagon is on the Heat. They're getting about 75% of the betting money, at least, that I see coming in from the bettors. I think that's a mistake. Miami Heat shot way too good to maintain that kind of presence in this game. The Hornets have a chance to keep this close. I think they sneak under the radar. This sprinkle a little bit on the money line, okay? But I'll take the points. Give me the Hornets plus the points. Also, I want to talk about the Detroit Pistons and the Cleveland Cavaliers. I really think Detroit Pistons played well in that first game against Cleveland, but they shot well from beyond the three-point arc. They don't do that every night. In fact, they're horrible at it. Cleveland wins going away. You know I hate laying chalk. You know I hate laying double digits. I'm going to do it here. Drop the 10 points. That's another pick for tonight. And, of course, I have to go on to Thursday night. I'm going to go two more picks on that, too. First of all, stay away from Golden State and Houston. The line, 5.5, seems real low. You want to drop that with Golden State. However, you don't know Curry's status. Plus, I don't know what to expect from Rockets. They're a nightmare. Could they put it together and get a win at home? Sure. I don't think it's going to happen. Give me the Pacers plus 1.5 at home. At home, in front of their crowd, they can play well. They've shown they can play with the Raptors. I think the Raptors are a better team, but I think the Pacers get the win here. And give me the Dallas Mavericks. I'm looking at 9, 9.5. That line goes up to 10. It's super juicy, but I'll take it. Oklahoma City, they're going to shoot better. I don't think this is a blowout. Mavericks, very experienced team. I don't think they win this game, but I think they keep it close. So that's four picks for the playoffs. Charlotte Hornets, Cleveland Cavaliers, Indiana Pacers, and Dallas Mavericks. That will do it for this segment. Whew, blazing quick with a few picks. Hope to keep the winning streak going, and make sure that you follow me on Twitter, at ColeRyan9. You can find me at ColeRyan and the number 9, and join the Buckets Brigade just by following me, like my latest follower, Castro, who jumped on board. And we're talking basketball each and every day. Trends, picks, news, who's in, who's out. I've got it all right there, and I love to talk basketball with everybody that hits me up. So just hit me up, and let's talk basketball and enjoy the NBA playoffs. And until then, win big, betting the Buckets.
Excellent stuff there, as always, from Cole Ryan. Become a member of the Buckets Brigade simply by following him on Twitter, at Cole Ryan and the number 9. Lots of stuff for me to get to here in the last 14 or so live streaming minutes of the show. I'm sure I'll go over again, so my apologies to the live listeners. But, you know, if you only have to listen to a couple minutes of the archive version, that's not too bad. I'll look at the NHL side of things first here, because I've got more stuff on the MLB side today. Washington laying $1.50 against Philadelphia. Michael Neuwirth going to be in net for the Flyers tonight. Obviously, everything that went on with the Flyers last game, you know, something that's going to resonate with Washington here. They are not interested in playing any additional games in this series. If Neuwirth can steal the game for Philadelphia, that's one thing. You know, I understand why people are taking Philadelphia backs against the wall. Washington doesn't necessarily want to win this game. But for Washington here, with Orpik down, with Orlov getting his bell rung a little bit, they just want this thing to be over. And if Philadelphia gets down 2-0 or something like that, you know, they're just going to be out for blood. They won't even be interested whatsoever in winning the game. So, you know, as this price continues to drop, I think Washington's worth a look. I think you can maybe money line parlay Washington with something on the MLB side of the docket. But, hey, if people want to back Philadelphia, that's fine. This Philadelphia team is done. I think there's some high character in a guy like Wayne Simmonds. But overall, I don't really like this Philadelphia team. I haven't throughout. You know that. So I would hope that Washington takes care of business tonight, just because I don't want to see any other Capitals get hurt, you know, for future rounds here of the playoffs. But the other three games, all very interesting. Florida and the Islanders. This one, effectively a money line pick'em type of game here with both sides -110. You've got varying prices out there in the market. You know, this is an important game for Florida, because if they lose this game, they go down 3-1. Yeah, they're going back home. But, you know, this is a spot where the Panthers really need to step up. And it's interesting, because I think the line suggests that, you know, when you look at some of these other numbers here, when you look at, you know, how Florida was favored at home, and then we see not a full home ice advantage given to the Islanders here in this series. I don't know if it's a Barclays Center thing. I'm not sure what it is. But, you know, seeing this game lined where it is was pretty interesting to me, because these two teams have shown to be pretty even here throughout the series. It's a matter of if Roberto Luongo stops pucks. And, you know, Luongo commented after game 3 that he was tired. You know, they had played 3 games in 4 days here to open up this series because of some scheduling issues in Florida, or some TV issues, or whatever the case was. But now 2 days off prior to this game, you figure Luongo should be good, but that also gives Thomas Greiss a chance to catch his breath. I previewed this game over at bangthebook.com, so you can read up more about that. The problem here, I hate to disappoint everybody, I don't have a strong play in the NHL tonight. And, you know, this game is a toss-up. The Dallas-Minnesota game is a toss-up to me as well, where you've got Dallas, you know, -120 road favorite, same line as game 3. Minnesota really stepped up in game 3. They really impressed me. They were down 2-0 very early, could have rolled over, could have folded the tent. Instead, it was Dallas that did that a little bit, and then they weren't able to, you know, respond quick enough to avoid losing game 3. So I think you get a better effort from Dallas. But for Minnesota here, you know, they prove that they can make this a reasonable series. So we'll see what kind of effort John Torchetti's team comes out with. It should be good. But a wide open game, that 5-3 score, doesn't really benefit Minnesota a whole lot in this series. So that's what I want to see. I want to see how both of these teams adjust to what happened in game 3. And also for Dallas, Kari Lehtinen needs to be better. I haven't seen if they're going with Niemi or Lehtinen tonight. But whoever's in net for Dallas needs to be better than what they got in game 3. And that was the concern for Dallas throughout for me, was, you know, I just didn't know what their goaltending was going to give. And in games 1 and 2, they were pretty good. Game 3, they weren't. So that's the big thing here tonight. And that's really a big reason why I don't have any strong opinions tonight, because goaltending is so big here, you know, in these swing games. I mean, these are games that can really swing the balance of a series. If Minnesota ties it, it's a different series. If Florida ties it, you know, they've got home ice advantage in a best of 3. So, you know, that's why these are such toss-up games, and goaltending a big reason why. The Kings and Sharks, Quick and Jones, again, those two guys, are really in the spotlight here. But the big thing for Los Angeles in Game 3 was that Anze Kopitar was outstanding. And what I talked about with the first two games, Joe Pavelski really carried things for San Jose. And Kopitar was kind of a passenger, didn't really do a whole lot. He stepped up in Game 3, made all the difference defensively for Los Angeles. And that's really important here for the Kings. They need to limit San Jose's offensive chances. They did that in Game 3. We'll see if they can have success with it in Game 4 tonight. San Jose, priced in the minus 120 range, about the same number that we saw for Game 3. Again, no strong thoughts on tonight's playoff action. I did get a chance to watch a little bit of Tampa Bay and Detroit yesterday. That was pretty interesting. One thing I noticed about Tampa Bay, moving forward, their power play could be a pretty big issue. You know, they're not relying on Steven Stamkos, so they're moving the puck around a little bit more. But they had about 8 or 9 left-handed shots on their two power play units. And that's tough. It makes it very tough to shoot that one timer. If you're on the off wing, it's okay. When you're catching passes across your body, when you're catching passes on the back, timing, and it allows the goaltender to get into position to make the save. So I think Tampa Bay gets past Detroit. I mean, they're up 3-1 in the series, but I'm very worried about Tampa Bay moving forward, you know, depending on who they play, because their special teams are going to take a little bit of a hit here without Stamkos and without Anton Strahlman, two right-handed shots. So those are very important things there. When you talk about the playoffs, you pay attention to little details like that, and that's why I try to watch as many of the games as I can, just to pick up on some of those little things. I do apologize for having no strong opinions on tonight's action, but you know what? That's not always a bad thing in the playoffs. You know, that's definitely not a bad thing with lines being as tight as they are. So we get over to the MLB side of things. And first, as I said, I have to apologize to Run Line Reese, who's a member of the Buckets Brigade, loyal listener of the show. I kind of lashed out at him a little bit yesterday, asking me about why I liked Shane Green, who was obviously terrible for the Tigers yesterday against the Royals. He cited some very relevant information. I mean, Shane Green, after that hot start last year for Detroit, where people kind of got this inflated perception of him, he was awful. He was really awful. And I cited on the show yesterday that, you know, Shane Green was a guy that saw a velocity spike in spring training, saw a strikeout spike. And you know, Run Line Reese correctly pointed out, and I mean, this is something, you know, that I do know, and that's what I kind of took a little bit of offense to, is that, you know, spring training is different than the regular season. And that's, of course, very true. I mean, you're facing patchwork lineups in spring training. You know, so strikeout and walk numbers aren't necessarily all that they're cracked up to be. But that Dan Rosenheck article at The Economist did say that, you know, there is predictive value in strikeout and walk rate improvements from spring training carrying over to the regular season. So, you know, that is something that I read. I wasn't talking about Shane Green's performance. I don't know how many runs he gave up. I don't know what his ERA was in spring training. I don't really care. I look for the stats that have, you know, relevant significance moving into the regular season. Now, for Green, he walked 4 guys in that game, and 3 of those walks came around to score. So, you know, what that shows is that you've got a guy that has a smaller margin for error because he's not a big strikeout guy, and you can't issue free passes to the Kansas City Royals. It's hard to walk Royals hitters. They don't want to walk. They want to put balls in play. When you do walk them, and they've got that lineup that puts balls in play, that's when you give yourself problems. So maybe that was something that I overlooked a little bit in that Shane Green start, but I do want to apologize to Run Line Reese for how I approached, you know, what he said to me on Twitter yesterday. It was certainly the wrong way to do it. I have no excuse for that. So, you know, Reese, I apologize for that. But looking at tonight's MLB card, you know, as I said, there's a lot of things to get to here on this card. And I wrote about some of these things in my picks and analysis article over at bangthebook.com for today that we've seen some significant line moves here at some of these places for tonight's action. I mean, you know, you saw R.A. Dickey open a favorite at some places against Baltimore. Now Jimenez a minus 115 favorite at some shops. BetOnline actually opened Dickey a favorite, and, you know, we can debate the merits of those BetOnline numbers. I wasn't signed into my odds screen, so I had some things that were a little bit off today when I was looking at that article. But, you know, looking at the odds screen now, you know, Dickey opened a small dog at some places, opened about a money line pick him at others, but we've seen Jimenez get money here. It's kind of leveled off a little bit now with some Dickey buyback. It's very tough. You know, I actually gave a little bit of a science lesson in my picks and analysis piece on Dickey that, you know, the knuckleball works best in cooler weather, and it's going to be about 70 degrees around first pitch here in Baltimore tonight. So that's not particularly good for Dickey. I don't think that's really the reason for the move. I think it's more that Dickey hasn't looked good that Ubaldo Jimenez has looked okay. You know, the one thing that you'll notice about Toronto here is until their offense gets going, they're going to be priced like that team that we saw last year. They're going to be priced like that offensive juggernaut that was historically good against lefties, really good against righties, had a middle of the order that hit, what, 120-some-odd home runs, something like that. But they got to get this thing going. And, you know, we saw the market capitalize there on some inflated perception on Toronto. Jimenez is a guy that, you know, he's difficult to back because he walks a ton of guys. He'll really piss you off in that respect. But a guy that's had decent command and, you know, doesn't really give up a lot of hits. So he's a tough guy to back, but at the same time, I think he gets kind of a bad rap, probably worse than he deserves, you know, because of the perception of him. So not really surprised to see some of that Baltimore money come in at some of those shops on the overnight lines. Another game of the big line move was Seattle and Cleveland. Taijuan Walker taking the ball for the Mariners. Danny Salazar going for the Indians tonight. Salazar opened a minus 145 favorite, minus 140, minus 145. Now sitting below minus 120, and there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that Salazar has only given up one run this year. It was a solo home run, but he has allowed 12 base runners. None of them have scored. So from a sabermetric standpoint, you look for regression in that. A 100% strand rate is not sustainable. You know, he's had some control issues. Also, Seattle's going to be pretty good against right-handed pitching this year. They've got some really good left-handed hitters, Kyle Seager, Robinson Cano. Seth Smith is a platoon guy on the right side of the platoon. Nelson Cruz hits everybody. So, you know, there's this perception out there about Seattle against righties, and I agree with it. What I don't agree with here is that I think some of this move on Taijuan Walker is based on what he did against the Indians last season. Through 14 innings, struck out 14, gave up one run, scattered 10 hits. But, you know, there's a couple of things here. A, don't take pitcher versus team stats seriously. I know that people justify picks by selling this to you where, you know, this pitcher is 5-1 with a 1.75 ERA against Philadelphia in his career. Okay, but what's the context? How many of those starts came, you know, recently? How many of those starts are back in the future? For Walker, you know, yeah, okay, fine. He's 2-0 with that low ERA and a strikeout per inning against the Indians. But Cleveland Indians, 19 plate appearances. He's allowed a 298, 368, 353 slash. That's batting average, on base, slugging percentage. And that's not significant at all. 19 plate appearances, that doesn't mean anything. So that's what I'm talking about. You know, yeah, he went 2-0. That's great. But he faced a lot of guys that didn't hit for the Indians or that aren't hitting for the Indians this year. So how relevant are those two starts? Not very relevant at all. So don't fall into this trap of batter versus pitcher stats or pitcher versus team stats or any of that garbage. The sample sizes are not big enough to be significant. They don't mean anything. Anything. Whether they're good or bad, they don't mean anything. You know, if a pitcher's given up, he's got a 7.28 ERA against, you know, I don't know, Washington or something like that in his career. Well, did he get rocked in one start and pitch well in two others? You know, did he pitch mediocre in two starts, get shelled in another, and then have three good outings? You know, you don't know. You can dig deeper into the context, and maybe you find out that way, but then if you've got two good starts, two bad starts, and two really awful starts, well, what's the midpoint, you know? What kind of performance can you actually expect to happen? So do not take batter versus pitcher stats or team versus pitcher stats or pitcher versus team stats and give them a lot of emphasis because they're not statistically significant. So I think that's part of what happened here with this Cleveland game where Walker pitched well against them last year, so people get all excited about it. The Indians are a different team this year, much different team. They've got several different hitters in this lineup right now. So don't consider that whatsoever. A couple other things I want to bring to your attention here. I got about 60 seconds left streaming live for the live listener crowd, so I do apologize for that. Chris Archer opened a slight favorite against Boston. Now he's a slight dog at most places. And this is a really tough spot for the odds makers, because Chris Archer is an elite level right-hander, but dating back to last September, he hasn't been very good. And that's the problem, is you've got this guy that has this reputation, that has incredible swing and miss stuff. What do you do with him? You know, you can't price him too high because then people are going to back him because he's that good and he has that potential on any given day to shut down a team. But you can't price him, you know, that low expecting him to be better because maybe there's something wrong there. And I think that that's the case with Archer tonight. I don't have a play on this game either way, But I wanted to bring it to your attention. You know, it should stand out to you when you see a pitcher, a big name guy, you know, in this low favorite, low underdog type of price range. And then you really want to dig deeper and find out why. And for Archer, it's been a lot of things. His control and command have both been terrible. I wrote a little bit more about this in my picks analysis article. I was watching when Archer was facing the Indians last week. And, you know, the Indians broadcasters had talked about, you know, one of the Tampa reporters came up to Archer and asked him about his velocity drop, which is, you know, has been pretty significant. And Archer sort of deflected the question, kind of downplaying it, asking why, you know, the media wasn't asking one of the other pitchers about his velocity drop. And that's not Chris Archer. If you've paid attention to Chris Archer, this is a guy that visits, you know, local baseball fields in every road city they go to. He's big into the RBI program, reviving baseball in inner cities. He's this fun, happy-go-lucky, optimistic, you know, very intelligent thinker. He filled in for some commentary in the playoffs last year on either Fox or ESPN, I'm not sure. But he was really, really insightful. I mean, he was downright brilliant on the air. This is a guy with an infectious personality, and somebody comes up and asks him that question, and he deflects it like that. He's frustrated, and you know, rightly so. I mean, this is a guy that's had a lot of success at the big league level. But that's something that's creeping in as well. You know, you look at that radar gun after a pitch, after something gets rocketed somewhere, and you know, you just think to yourself, I'm reaching back, and I'm sitting 90, 91, 92. I should be sitting 94, 95. What the hell's going on here? Then you start overthrowing. Then you lose your command, so on and so forth. You know, the mental side of the game is really big too. And for Archer right now, it just doesn't seem like he's in a good place. So while I'm not ready to back Rick Porcello and all of his command problems and all the issues with him, Archer's a guy that is worrisome to me right now. And, you know, it's a guy that we're going to want to watch here moving forward. As for some plays that I do like tonight, I agree with the move on Wei-Yin Chen for the Marlins against the Washington Nationals. We saw the Nationals open about a minus 115 favorite. Wei-Yin Chen now up to a minus 115 favorite at some shops. This is a game that later in the season I would have been all over. It's a game that, you know, with a couple starts under each starter's belt, I didn't really put too much stock into it. But I see why there's a reason for the line move. If you look at this game here, you know, and I went a little bit more in detail with it in my article, Joe Ross has allowed one of his 12 base runners to score. 7 of 14 base runners for Wei-Yin Chen have scored. So 55.6% strand rate for him. Ross's is up in the 91 percentile. Both of those are going to regress. And this is a sign of what I'll be looking for later in the season. You've got Ross, who's got a 0.61 ERA and a 365 XFIP. You've got Chen, I think his ERA is 6 or 7, something like that. And a reasonable XFIP because he doesn't walk anybody, doesn't give up home runs. So we're seeing statistics that I like to use being applied here in this game. ERA to XFIP, you know, discrepancy. BABIP, batting average on balls in play. For Chen, his is 343. For Ross, his is 200. Those are both unsustainable. Left on base, which is strand rate. You know, so those are the things that I look for once sample sizes get a little bit bigger. But the market already jumping in on this one here. So I agree with the move tonight on Miami. I do like the Marlins in this spot tonight. Another spot I like here is Kansas City, and this is for a little bit of a different reason. Ian Kennedy is a guy that, you know, we backed last week, had a very good start in his outing, and he's going up against Jordan Zimmermann and the Tigers. And the Tigers, you know, laid a big egg yesterday, and that has nothing to do with my play today. But Zimmermann's walked 5 guys in 13 innings. He walked 29 guys in 199.2 innings in all of 2013. Now, is control problems this early in the season a red flag? No, not necessarily. But Jordan Zimmermann doesn't face the pitcher anymore. He faces an extra hitter in the lineup. You know, there's not as much slap hitting. There's not as much situational hitting in the American League as there is in the National League. So that's why we, in a general sense, see pitchers that go from the National League to the American League have about a 10% drop in overall performance. For Zimmermann, I think that includes his walk rate here. So I think this is something that can be a little bit predictive moving forward. As I mentioned, Kansas City doesn't walk a ton, so maybe this isn't a spot where it's, you know, too significant. But Zimmermann's a pitch-to-contact guy. That's Kansas City's bread and butter. You know, they put everything in play, it seems like. Zimmermann throwing more sliders here in the American League, and that's why the walk rate's gone up. It's a tougher pitch to command. So I'm going to watch the usage for Zimmermann. I'm going to watch how that walk rate has gone. I'm going to watch how he adjusts to the American League. But for tonight, with the way that Ian Kennedy's throwing, you know, taking on a right-handed heavy lineup for the Tigers, I like the Royals tonight. Kennedy's become an extreme fly ball guy. Very extreme. I believe his ground ball rate's like 29% this year so far through two starts. And that's a good thing because Kansas City's outfield defense is phenomenal. It's the best in the league by a large margin. So you get strikeouts, you induce weak aerial contact that your guys can go run down. It's a recipe for success right there, man. So Ian Kennedy, I think, is a guy that I'll be watching pretty closely here. I think he's good today. And we will get to a point where we can go against Ian Kennedy because everyone will start buying in, and then that's when you probably want to jump ship. But I do like Kansas City tonight. Another play I really, really like tonight is Milwaukee. Jimmy Nelson, $125 favorite against Minnesota. The reason why here is that you've got this Minnesota team having to go without its designated hitter. And if you look around baseball, the team that ranks second in WOBA with its DH is the Minnesota Twins. Byung-ho Park and also Joe Mauer have been very, very good in that DH role. One of those guys has to come out of the lineup here. That's problematic for a Minnesota team that's really had a lot of issues scoring runs. From the other side of things, Milwaukee, some good right-handed power bats, Ryan Braun, Domingo Santana, Chris Carter, Jonathan Lucroy. They take on Tommy Malone here in this one. Malone, your traditional soft-tossing lefty at Miller Park, that could be a problem for him. So I like Milwaukee here tonight. There was a little bit of a move on Minnesota early on because Milwaukee, probably shouldn't be a minus 130 favorite against anybody. But I like the value here tonight on Jimmy Nelson, a guy that's been priced rather interestingly in the betting market throughout, his first few starts. But, I do like the Brewers here in this spot. Laying chalk on them on a regular basis, not a good idea. But tonight I think it works. One final thought I want to leave you with, and here's the importance of doing research. And FanGraphs is the holy grail for me of places to do research. I was looking at the Houston and Texas game today, and you've got Doug Fister against Cole Hamels, and Hamels opened in the minus 140 range, and now this number is sitting in the minus 120 range. And it made no sense to me. Doug Fister's a guy we went against last week. He pitched awful. So, looking at this one against a guy like Cole Hamels, who great swing and miss stuff, Houston lineup that swings and misses quite a bit. This move doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I started digging. When you see a line that piques your interest, you start digging. You start looking, what am I missing? So I went and looked at Cole Hamels. Hamels has had some control issues a little bit here this year. And I kind of looked at them on the surface. And then I saw what Jeff Zimmerman wrote over at FanGraphs. And what he was looking at is that not only has Hamels had a velocity drop, but his zone percentage has dropped from 47% to less than 40%. Zone percentage is number of pitches as classified by PitchFX as being in the strike zone. You want to throw strikes. You don't want to throw strikes right down the middle. You want to throw quality strikes, but you still want to throw pitches over the plate. For Hamels, that's the issue here, is he's not throwing enough pitches over the plate, and he's also had some velocity problems here. So there are some big-time red flags with Cole Hamels. I mean, this is a guy that's had some shoulder issues in the past, generally tends to pitch through them, but that shoulder may be barking a little bit. So that's why you get the move on Houston tonight. I don't think that the betting public dug as deep into Cole Hamels' problems as I just did. They probably just saw Houston catching plus 140 or plus 130 and said, well, there's no way they should be that big of a dog against anybody. And, maybe so. They're betting on numbers and not teams. I'm going to watch Hamels very, very closely here for you on this, over the next few weeks so I can talk about it on the show. But those are the things I look for. I look for injury indicators that'll help us go against pitchers, and we'll get some of them throughout the season here. I know there was a lot of information to throw at you, but I wanted to make sure that I talked about some of the things that I look for in the future. Not as much now because sample sizes are pretty small, but we are seeing some examples here in the betting market of people doing the same things that I do and seeing subsequent line moves as a result. So, I just wanted to bring that to your attention here. One last thing I want to mention with regards to Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball here, and this is from Darren Heitner over at Forbes. He wrote this yesterday. Major League Baseball has been using some integrity monitoring services to follow their betting lines over the last couple of years. This is something that they partnered with a company in Europe to do this. They're partnered with Sporting Pulse, and Sporting Pulse just merged with Bet Genius to create Genius Sports. And so now you've got Major League Baseball with this, what was an affiliation to gambling beforehand, a much stronger affiliation now to gambling where they're monitoring the betting markets, you know, using this BetGenius thing, which BetGenius had some software that, you know, would help books set numbers. And, you know, Rob Manfred has been open-minded about sports handicapping in the past, talked about it in November. There's a quote from Heitner in this Forbes piece, you know, with some of the things that Manfred said late last year. We're moving in the right direction. It's going very, very slowly, but we are moving in the right direction here. You know, there was a panel discussion here at the U.S. Capitol Visitors Center coming up on Wednesday. They'll talk about sports betting and integrity. So, you know, it's getting out there. It's getting into the mainstream. It's starting to become a little bit more of a topic, you know, in Washington. So we're moving in the right direction here with these things. And, you know, these professional sports leagues, you've got MLB that's slowly getting on board. You've got the NBA that's going to be on board. You've got the NFL that, while they're not on board, they fully understand that fantasy football, daily fantasy, gambling, all those things drive the bus, drive the ratings market. The NCAA will be the hard one to convince, but we're moving in the right direction. It's going slowly, but we are moving in the right direction. And this, you know, MLB partnership here, you know, something that's not even, it's not even thinly veiled. It's just openly out there that this is, you know, related to sports betting, you know, that things are going in the right direction for us. So again, coming up on Thursday, we'll have Jordan Bianchi of SB Nation talk NASCAR. Also, Jay Primetime, MMAoddsbreaker.com. Apologize for running a little bit long here with today's show. Apologize again to Runline Reese for the way that I reacted on Twitter yesterday. It's been a rough couple of days. That's no excuse. But you know, for those that have reached out and asked, you know, thank you very much for your concern with some of the family issues that I've been having. I do appreciate that. It's nice to know that the listeners, you know, aren't just here for picks. You know, actually do get invested in the show and in some of the personalities that we have on the air, both myself and the guests. So that really does mean a lot. But with that, I'm going to take a deep breath and wrap up today's show. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow.